This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. Republican presidential hopefuls hold another debate. The South Sudan conflict faces a grim milestone. A new dinosaur discovered in China.
They're small. They're probably about the size of a spaniel. They walk on their hind legs, but they have pretty big heads.
And the new Star Wars movie off to a big, big start. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. Republican Party presidential contenders held their fifth debate of the campaign season Tuesday night in Las Vegas, Nevada. Nine presidential hopefuls participated with a focus on terrorism and national security. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone is here to talk about the debate. Jim, how did it go?
Well, Ray, we've seen in recent weeks, of course, the world focus on the attacks in California and previously in Paris, and that was certainly on the minds of the Republican presidential contenders Tuesday. No doubt about it that the focus was on the threat of terrorism, national security, and how best to defeat the Islamic State. And the candidates went at it pretty well. In particular, there was some clashes between Donald Trump, who's the Republican frontrunner, and Jeb Bush, the one who many people thought might emerge early on as a leading candidate, but who's lagging in the polls. And Bush seemed to be challenging Trump, particularly on that issue of Trump's proposal to ban non-American Muslims from coming into the United States. He's drawn, of course, international fire for that. So Trump was not dominating this debate as we've seen in the past, and much of it was about military tactics, how best to defeat the Islamic State, and how to keep Americans safe.
Jim, were there any surprises to come out of this?
Well, I did see a lot of airtime here for Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. We haven't heard a lot from him in the past. Paul has taken issue with the idea of nation building, with putting American troops on the ground in the Middle East. He departs from many of the Republican contenders who want a more robust military presence in the Middle East. And he had plenty of time to make his points tonight. He also differs from some of them in terms of how to keep America safe through the bulk collection of American phone records. This is something that's been debated in the Senate. And it was the subject in the debate between not only Rand Paul, but Senators Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, as was immigration. So a lot of the debates that we used to see in the Senate came to the fore tonight in this Republican presidential debate.
In the usual give and take, was there any contender that had an off night?
Well, I'd have to go back a little bit to Donald Trump. I'm going to be interested to see how this is reviewed. At one point, Trump was challenged by Jeb Bush about his leadership skills, how he would deal with Russian President Vladimir Putin, for example. And Trump started complaining about CNN, the host network, and how they allow the candidates to be asked questions about things that Trump has said and then get them to respond. It seemed a little off, and I'll be interested to see what the reviews are about Trump's performance. He's done very well in the polls. He's had some good debates in the past. I'm not sure this was one of his best ones.
Where does the Republican presidential race go from here?
Well, we're going to head into a little Christmas holiday break, I think, for the campaigns over the next few weeks. So it was an important night to see which contenders could make an impression. But they'll start up after the calendar new year quite quickly because the Iowa caucuses shape up on February 1st, and that'll really get things going.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. That's VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone. Tensions remain between the United States and Russia concerning the ongoing conflict in Syria. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry traveled to Moscow Tuesday to meet with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, and President Vladimir Putin. Mr. Kerry says they have the ability to make a significant difference in Syria's crisis. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dokken spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about what the talks accomplished.
The U.S. and Russia appear to have bridged some of their gaps on Syria, after a meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov and President Vladimir Putin. The Secretary of State John Kerry and Lavrov had a news conference, and Kerry said that while the U.S. and Russia don't see eye to eye on every aspect of Syria, they see Syria fundamentally in similar ways. He said the U.S. and Russia see the same challenges, they see the same dangers, and want the same outcome. Lavrov said the U.S. and Russia agreed to intensify counterterrorism efforts, coordinate more militarily, and continue work on listing terrorist organizations in Syria.
President Putin, through a translator, had mentioned that the United States and Russia together were looking for ways out of the most urgent crises, the unrest in Ukraine and Islamic State militants in Syria. The two countries are coming at this a little bit from different angles, as in both of those cases, Russia is seen as going into the situation. How did that play out in the talks?
Well, in particular with Ukraine, Secretary Kerry mentioned that if there's full compliance with the Minsk Agreement, which is a ceasefire, but there have been some violations of it, as well as a withdrawal of forces into the border, and the United States and EU would roll back sanctions that were imposed on Russia for its support of separatists in Syria. Also, in terms of Syria in general, in terms of Syria, the two sides agreed that they would cooperate more militarily. And they also said that on most aspects of Syria, there is agreement.
The West has criticized Russia for its involvement and the airstrikes, saying that they have not targeted Islamic State as much as they claim to have been. And was Secretary Kerry able to bridge that gap a little bit?
He did not specifically address that, but Lavrov, in his comments, did say the two sides would cooperate more militarily, perhaps down the road, perhaps that will lead to more of a targeted focus on militants. They also mentioned that there had been progress on a list to designate which militant groups in Syria were terrorist groups. This is a Jordan-led process, and they said there had been progress on that front.
VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Moscow endorsed a plan for a third round of talks in New York this Friday to discuss a political transition in Syria. We continue with a look at events in the Middle East, where the latest archaeological find is making headlines and buzzing online. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me to tell us more. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. Buzzing online today is a talk of the world's most famous Jew. We're talking about Jesus Christ, the founder of Christianity. A medical artist drew the religious figure based on forensic and anthropological research. You can find links to a number of articles on this story, but for our segment, let's go to a link provided by the Esquire magazine's Twitter account. Richard Nee from England drew a picture of what he thinks Jesus would have looked like with the help of British scientists and Israeli archaeologists.
There were lots of pictures drawn of Jesus through the centuries. What kind of credibility does this Richard Nee have?
Well, I would say he's a leading figure when it comes to recreating historical figures. Neve has reconstructed dozens of famous faces in the past two decades, including Philip II of Macedonia and the father of Alexander the Great.
Well, that's some impressive company. What are the processes he uses for this?
So Neve and his team derive from the Bible that Jesus had typical features of his countrymen at that time, so the team acquired three skulls from Jerusalem, where he lived, to figure out the bone structure. As for his hair and coloration, they turned to drawings dating back to the first century, so these drawings were done before the Bible was compiled, and the team concluded Jesus had dark eyes and short curly hair. In keeping with Jewish tradition, he probably had full beard. Ray, I'm not sure about our listeners in Africa, but people who grew up in the West and Asia are more familiar with a different type of Jesus.
That certainly is the case. We're more used to the Jesus that has long, flowing hair and lighter features made in countless motion pictures. That's our image of him, the Caucasian version.
Exactly. But if you think about it, the Semitic version of Jesus should not be a surprise because many people seem to agree. Let's read one comment from the Epoch Times Facebook post. Three skulls later, we have Jesus. I am impressed, and seemingly he wasn't white. Now I am shocked. Whoever thought someone born to non-white parents and living 2,000 years ago in the Middle East would be white? That sarcastic reply got more than 100 likes. Many news articles and experts are hailing the latest image as the most accurate depiction of Jesus. Back to you.
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at Gabby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. And also tell us what you think on our program's account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
This is VOA's International Edition. Despite an August peace plan and the presence of thousands of UN peacekeepers, South Sudan's conflict entered its second year Tuesday with tens of thousands killed and more than 2 million displaced. Almost 4 million are considered food insecure. Leslie Lefko is Deputy Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. Speaking to International Edition's Victor Beatty from Amsterdam, she says, tragically, there's been little in the way of implementation of the August 26th peace agreement.
We see continuing attacks on civilians in certain areas of the country. We've seen very little progress, if any, on accountability and justice. The larger problem of violence and impunity in this country remains a massive challenge.
Is this an international responsibility and breakdown in responsibility, or is this a governmental problem?
Well, I think first and foremost, the responsibility lies with the individual leaders in South Sudan who have created this crisis, who have prolonged this crisis, and who continue to fail to take the steps that are necessary to protect civilians, to protect their own people, and to stop this horrific violence. But the international community also bears responsibility. South Sudan's partners, I think, bear a serious portion of responsibility for failing to stress that South Sudan's leadership needed to put protection and promotion of human rights at the forefront of their agenda for years, well before this conflict started.
There have been numerous promises for a ceasefire and a truce and an end to the conflict. Nothing seems to happen. Why?
There's a long-standing cycle of leaders in South Sudan basically being rewarded for their violence and, you know, being rewarded either monetarily or with political positions without, you know, very few conditions. And I think this is a long-standing problem. There's also been, you know, very few consequences in the past, including in the long civil war that gave birth to South Sudan. There's been very few consequences for the kind of crimes that we've seen in the last 2 years, but also seen in the past by many of these same commanders who are involved today. So I think there's a sense that that crime actually does pay.
Leslie Lefko, Deputy Africa Director for Human Rights Watch, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Human Rights Watch issued a new 65-page report based on interviews that denounces the continued widespread use of child soldiers by both rebels and the government. The UN Children's Fund estimates up to 16,000 children may have been used in the two-year-old conflict. The Federal Aviation Administration, which regulates all air traffic within the United States, released new guidelines on the use of drones. It will link all unmanned aircraft with their owners through mandatory registration. The aim is to educate drone owners about safety and responsibility, as well as to connect the aircraft with their owners. International Edition Susan Yaki spoke with VOA's George Putich about the rules and how they'll work.
FAA finally released regulations according to which all drones will have to be registered because there were problems with the security and some near misses in encounters of drones with regular aircraft. So FAA finally decided to put some regulation into it.
And do these steps go into effect immediately?
Almost immediately. December 21st is the first date until after which all drones purchased previously will have to be registered with FAA. The registering process is quite simple. It's online or on paper, of course. It costs $5 to register a drone, which is, interestingly, the same price FAA charges for registering any kind of aircraft.
Oh, that is interesting.
From Cessna to Boeing 787. And all drones, as I said, will have to be registered, all previously purchased drones. And then from February 16th, all drones will have to be registered before their first flight.
Now, this all is coming about because some near mishaps with drones and aircraft.
Correct. There were some mishaps. There were some close encounters, as I said, and which is making pilots very nervous. So FAA says the security is the primal reason, but they want also the public to be educated. They say everybody who is operating a drone is actually a pilot and needs to know something about flying the drone.
Well, what are some of these things people should know before they take off with their drones?
Basically, they have to keep the drones on the levels lower than 400 feet and also have to stay clear from the airports.
We've heard of some drones getting close enough to planes that the pilots have actually complained that the drones were in their way.
That is correct. Some people were very obviously negligent about the safety, so they were flying drones, or maybe they were trying to get some videos of airplanes flying close by. So they were flying close to the airports, which is, of course, very dangerous and should be avoided at all costs.
Well, we've seen birds going into the engine of a plane and the trouble that can cause. Just imagine if a drone was sucked into an engine.
Correct. That would be really, really very bad.
VOA's George Putich talking with my colleague Susan Yaki. Still to come, Star Wars mania.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
There is a new symbol of a little salt shaker appearing on menus in chain restaurants in New York City. The image is on any menu item containing more than 2,300 milligrams of sodium, or about a teaspoon of salt, the recommended daily limit for individuals. New Yorkers consume considerably more than that on average. Specialist Dr. Howard Weintraub says excess salt intake is a factor in cardiovascular disease.
Elevated blood pressure and the sodium work alone and together to create vascular damage.
New Yorkers like Paul Fichter mostly agree the new salt emblem is a positive addition to chain menus.
It's good that people know that, hey, there's a little more sodium than, you know, your daily recommended value and something that you're eating, especially when you're eating out.
Cardiovascular disease was the leading cause of death in New York City in 2013, claiming nearly 17,000 lives. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. The remains of a tiny version of the huge Triceratops dinosaur, no bigger than a small dog, have been unearthed in fossil beds in China. The discovery pushes the origins of the popular-filled horned dinosaur back in time by tens of millions of years. VOA's Jessica Berman has details.
The tiny plant eater named Walionceratops lived approximately 160 million years ago during the early late Jurassic period. It would be another 100 million years before the huge horned Triceratops appeared on the scene. Catherine Forster is a paleontologist at George Washington University in Washington who helped identify the remains of the mini dinosaur, which, unlike Triceratops, had no horns.
They're small. They're probably about the size of a spaniel. They walked on their hind legs, but they had pretty big heads. Their heads were kind of outsized relative to their bodies, but they were just small little plant-eating animals.
Fossils of another Triceratops cousin from the same era, a larger dinosaur named Yinlong, were discovered in the same area of China in 2002, although paleontologists didn't know then what they had until they compared the two sets of bones. Only when they found Walionceratops did scientists realize they were getting to the roots of what evolved into Triceratops, which Forster says had crazy head stuff that began to appear in the smaller creature.
They have a tiny little neck frill sticking out behind their head. And they also have, like all other Ceratopsian dinosaurs, they have this extra little bone that's stuck on the end of its upper jaw. And so all Ceratopsians have that. So these little guys have that, the little early members have it, and all the big later members have it as well.
Forster says it's hard to know for certain, but suggests the head frill may have served as ornamentation to attract and interact with members of its own species. Like its bigger cousin, Walionceratops was stocky. It had teeth all along its jaw. But 100 million years later, Triceratops had evolved razor-sharp molars packed in the back of its mouth, probably an adaptation for eating tough vegetation. Forster says she looks forward to making other dinosaur discoveries.
Absolutely, and we have a better idea of the timing of that diversification. We know it had already happened by the early part of the late Jurassic. So if we go back into older rocks, we might be able to find older members of these lineages and try to kind of trace it back to the beginning of Ceratopsians.
With the discovery of Walionceratops reported in the journal PLOS One, Forster says it appears there was more diversity among the early horned dinosaurs than was previously recognized. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
While movie fans in the United States eagerly await the latest installment of the Star Wars saga, Star Wars: The Force Awakens, to open at theaters throughout the country this week, some people have already gotten a chance to see it. It premiered Monday in Los Angeles. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the long-awaited film is living up to the anticipation and offers fans a new story for a new generation.
A who's who of Hollywood turned out for the premiere in Los Angeles Monday night. Star Wars: The Force Awakens takes up the story 30 years after the end of The Return of the Jedi. The galaxy is still at war between the forces of the First Order, an offshoot of the old Galactic Empire, and the Resistance, the next generation of the old Rebel Alliance. The film features many of the heroes from the saga, including Han Solo, Leia Organa, Chewbacca, R2-D2, and C-3PO. Anthony Daniels, who plays the protocol droid C-3PO, said Monday that director J.J. Abrams has produced a film that a new generation of fans will fall in love with.
Because the care and attention, the love, the detail, everything, the enthusiasm, the excitement that J.J. and the whole team brought to it, and the cast, it's being echoed tonight.
Harrison Ford reprises his role as smuggler and rebel fighter Han Solo. He said it was great to be back in the old role.
You know, people have been anticipating this film for a long time, and that's a good thing. And we had a really good script, and J.J. is a director that I really admire, have for a long, long time. I was pleased to be back.
Adam Driver plays the new villain in the series, Kylo Ren, who has sworn to take revenge on the rebels for destroying the Empire. Driver says the magnitude of his role didn't hit him until he got on set.
It really didn't hit me, actually, until I walked into this guy's office, who's Michael Kaplan, who did the costumes for it, and I saw everybody's drawing on the wall, and that was the first time that I it really hit me. And oh, it's a Star Wars movie.
John Boyega plays Finn, a stormtrooper who finds his loyalties divided between the First Order and the Resistance. Boyega says that being part of the iconic series is mind-boggling.
Yeah, I feel great. I feel fantastic, and I feel surprisingly relaxed. I mean, this is an environment that I feel like is loving enough. I'm a Star Wars fan, so I feel like we're paying homage to a film that I really respect, so I feel good.
Star Wars The Force Awakens also stars Oscar winner Lupita Nyong'o. Daisy Ridley plays Rai, a scavenger who gets drawn into the conflict. Mark Hamill reprises his role of Luke Skywalker, the Jedi Master, and Carrie Fisher returns as Leia. Game of Thrones star Gwendolyn Christie stars as Captain Phasma, the first female stormtrooper.
I just feel like Lucasfilm and Disney have listened to what people want. And in being more diverse with the casting choices and creating characters like Captain Phasma, I think they've really listened to what it is people want to see on their screens.
Star Wars The Force Awakens opens in wide release in the United States Friday. It is the first of four new Star Wars movies due out by 2019. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has continued to support the peaceful management and resolution of territorial and maritime disputes in the South China Sea. U.S. President Barack Obama reiterated this message during recent meetings in Southeast Asia, where he called for a halt to recent construction on disputed islands and submerged features in the South China Sea. We agree on the need for bold steps to lower tensions, including pledging to halt further reclamation, new construction, and militarization of disputed areas in the South China Sea, he said. China, Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, Brunei, and Taiwan all claim sovereignty over some or all of the land features in the South China Sea. However, since 2014, China has engaged in land reclamation on seven features in the Spratly Islands, where the Philippines and several other countries also have claims. The Philippines has recently brought elements of its dispute with China under the Law of the Sea Convention to an arbitral tribunal in The Hague. While the U.S. does not take a position on the territorial claims of each nation, it insists that all claims be based on international law and that differences be addressed peacefully through diplomatic and legal means. That's why, said President Obama, the United States supports the Philippines' decision to use arbitration under the U.N. Convention on the Law of the Sea to peacefully and lawfully address differences. The South China Sea is home to many valuable resources, including an important fishing industry. Vital shipping lanes traverse the area, carrying over half the world's merchant shipping tonnage. The U.S. insists that behavior by all countries uphold the principles of freedom of navigation and overflight, unimpeded lawful commerce, respect for international law, and the peaceful resolution of disputes.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.